Welcome to The Found Symbol. We are four actual Freemasons, and we're going to discuss all the symbols, signs, and Easter eggs in episode 2, Araf, of Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. Okay, I'm John, and with me tonight we have Jason, Joe, and Brother Jamie. So, hello and good evening. And just fair warning, if you haven't seen episode 2 of The Lost Symbol, spoilers ahead. There will be lots of symbols and signs and screenshots of the show, so it'll be fine going into. But before we get into it, definitely want to say it's a big departure from the book. Now, the first episode stuck, 90% with the book. Now they're starting to adapt it for TV and actually throw some new things in there. So if you've read the book, it's not exactly as it seems. What do you guys think so far? Good episode?
Yeah, good so drama, far it's, I think.
Yeah, so far it's still good. It's only getting about 55% on Rotten Tomatoes, but it's decent. Again, I really like the cast. Because of what I know them from previous work. So it to me is entertaining. There's some things in there that are a bit spookier or more far-fetched than they should be, but this is Dan Brown, so we'll go with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this episode was kind of a filler episode, right, to kind of move the story along. Didn't have as much spooky stuff hidden in there. But where the first one whetted your appetite, this one's carrying you through character development and through some of the other parts of the show. So without further ado, I do want to get right into some of the symbolism there. And I want to start with the actual episode title. So the episode title is Araf. And if you're not familiar with that concept, it's actually an Islamic concept found in the Quran where it's a separator between heaven and hell. And so if you look at this diagram over here, here are some different pictorial views of this concept of the Araf. And you see on the left here, just kind of a hand drawing and then a modern interpretation on the right. And this line separating right down the middle is this separation, the English translation it stands for the heights or the wall. And so this is the wall between heaven and hell. And this is kind of used, especially by name, at the very end of the episode where, we're putting Malak is putting Solomon in this suspended animation, this kind of not quite alive, not quite dead state where he's physically in between the two worlds. And and for those who are of kind of the Catholic faith or the Catholic inclination, it's believed that the Al-Araf or the heights or this sense of being in between is where the sense of purgatory came from. So has influenced the Catholic interpretation of purgatory or in limbo. So I think it's an interesting choice of the title, as well as the state of being that the enemy or Malak is placing one of the main characters.
Is there a correlative to that and Dante's cosmology, like Dante's Purgatorio, for example, that you found? I mean, is there, you said it feeds into the, the Catholic current, but but is there a direct correlative between Al-Araf and Dante's idea of Purgatorio in his cosmology, that it would separate? Have you found anything about that?
I would assume there's a connection there, but I haven't looked that up.
I was going to ask the same thing, just in a more dumb way, that my thoughts on Catholic purgatory were very, very, very tied to Dante Alighieri, right? And his book.
Right.
In fact, that's how a lot of Christians get their idea of what hell looks like, right? Because that stuff's not written in the Bible, but they get it from Inferno. So it's just interesting how that's kind of related a little bit, you know.
And it's Aristotelian, like the Islamic cosmology being Aristotelian as well. So it would be almost a, you know, there would be a correspondence there in that they are both post Thomas Aquinas in the Catholic part of it, that there would be a correlative between these two Aristotelian kind of systems.
Yeah, and also go ahead, Jason.
I thought it was interesting how they portrayed, you know, Peter Solomon's state in the Araf in the episode as him being in almost somewhat of a pseudo sensory deprivation tank. Mm-hmm. So it's literally just, you know, almost, it's not completely enclosed like a lot of sensory deprivation tanks are, but he's in the water. He's sedated. There's just a lot of nothingness. And so that to me struck a very symbolic tone, tying in, you know, the state of purgatory with this state of literally being in limbo.
Mm-hmm. Now in the book, you know, he actually submerges both Peter Solomon and Robert Langdon in this breathable liquid, which really kind of sedates them into this mental state of, you know, a dreamlike state. And so, you know, it's also strange how they jumped right to that in this part of the only the second episode of at least a 10-part series.
Is that the same magic goo that you breathe in the, what was that movie, The Abyss?
The Abyss, yes.
Yes, yes. It was.
Yes, breathe it in. A real thing, though. That's the cool part. Science is awesome. All right, let's get to the next symbol then. And this is... as they are progressing through the tunnels, they open up the little secret wax sealed letter from Peter Solomon and uncover a Bible verse.
It is a Bible verse, and they use the super cool translation app, which I think is it Google, John? You're the big Google file in the group. Is it Google that is adding real-time translation?
Yes, you can do that in the
I know Apple has it out. Yeah, has it for their next release, but really cool. You'll be able to go to foreign countries and talk into your phone and it will respond for you in another language, but I digress. So this magic Google app found 1 Kings chapter 3, which is they called it the Judgment of Solomon, but it's really two parts. The first part before verse 18, which they kept pointing their finger at for some reason, talks about how Solomon asked for, you know, God had told him that he would give him whatever he wanted, and he said wisdom, and God was super pleased with that. But when we get to verse 18, if you read it, it talks about his, you know, where he actually uses that wisdom. It's the story of the two women with the one baby. Everybody knows the story. But I tried to see if there was something cool or esoteric or hidden in the actual Hebrew, because they said, you know, they're different words. So in the original, you have the Hebrew word vayahi, which all it means is so there it was, or there is this, you know, is the start of a sentence. And then in the Peter Solomon version, they have the word kishelish, which means a third. So there's nothing magical in there, unless we want to talk about threes later, but they literally just transpose two different words together. So no awesome sauce there.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing Masonic specifically about that Bible verse, but it is kind of cool. One, it's referencing King Solomon, who is a prominent figure in Freemasonry. And again, in the Solomaic text, it is one of my favorite parts of where, you know, God appears to Solomon in a dream and says, you can have anything you want. And he asks for wisdom. And I think that's a really cool lesson to be taken away. You know, not gold, not riches, not women, but wisdom. And he gets all that plus more.
Plus wisdom being associated with the Ionic order of architecture, which goes in the East. Wisdom, strength, and beauty are three pillars.
There you go. So let's talk about the number three. We talked a little bit about the number three in the first episode, and it's referenced again in this episode. So Jason, why do we care about the number three?
So again, you know, the Triskel or the Triskelion shows up again in episode two, is featured prominently in connection with the Turkish prison that Peter Solomon's son is in. And so that that comes back to bear again in this episode. And remember, you know, we talked about the Triskel being kind of a Trinitarian idea associated with threes, you know, life, death, rebirth, things of those nature or things of that nature. And it's interesting that Sato says, oh, well, it's the Triskel. It's a very important symbol to Freemasonry. I had not come across that symbol in my travels.
You're not high enough, Jason.
Yeah,
Jamie,
exactly.
Does Jamie know about the secret Triskel that's very Masonic, but we have no idea what the hell they're talking about?
Well, I know that we use a therefore symbol to sort of truncate brother and worshipful master and things like, you know, the therefore the symbol, mathematical the three. Symbol. Mm-hmm. Right. A logical, mathematical symbol for therefore. But I'm not sure. You know, I got to tell you, I didn't watch the show. I'm sorry. I didn't read the book or watch the show.
We brought our own Robert Langdon on just to talk about symbols. So it's all good. Yeah.
You're our symbol guy. Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
But threes do play a very important role in Masonry. Right. You know, Jamie alluded to the, you know, the three pillars, the three stations, you know, east, west, and south, wisdom, strength, and beauty.
Right. You know, the three columns of the Kabbalistic tree of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, so we can talk about threes and sacred threes for days on the show, but we won't subject everyone to that.
Right. The active, the passive, and the neuter. Absolutely. All right. So we're there first, still here in the first couple minutes of the episode. And after they interpret the Bible verse, then they realize they're being chased by some CIA agents, and they get a random encoded text that says, pass the wayfarer, find the wolf. And that's the way they find their way out of danger's way, which is fascinating here because they don't show the wayfarer at all, but yet they find the wolf right away, pop a panel, and next thing you know, they're hiding into a wall and climbing to safety. But it's then referenced in the immediate next scene where they run into Peter Solomon's friend, the architect of the U.S. Capitol, who's also a 33rd degree Mason, and said, oh, that was really smart of you to send us towards the Wayfarer and by Bosch, right? And they say, yep, that's it. And then they move on. They don't show this painting anywhere, but what they're actually referring to is a painting done in the 1500s, which is supposed to have Masonic connections to this. So this painting called The Wayfarer or The Peddler is by artist Hieronymus Bosch, painted circa 1500, and is really about the story of the return of the prodigal son. You can see a lot of order on the right-hand side and a lot of chaos on the left-hand side. And you know, I certainly want everyone to kind of go look up this picture on its own in its own high resolution, because you'll see some really wild stuff. In fact, you'll find that the house on the left is actually a brothel. And you'll see that it's in disarray. You'll see there's a guy peeing behind the corner. And what's just interesting to note is that if you read this painting from left to right in threes, you'll see that it's chaos. It's the aspirant or the person who's actually trying to make a choice going left or right in their life. And then there's order in these, these farm animals on the right, this very, you know, staged, fenced in area. And so it's really meant to show the choice of this traveler of, do they go back to their old wild ways or are they going more towards order? what's interesting Masonically is that it's not been really been proven. We really can trace our documented organization of Freemasonry to about 1717. We know it existed as operative camps previous to 1717, but this painting, while painted in 1500, you know, over 200 years before the foundation of organized regular Masonry today, specular Freemasonry, we see a lot of interesting symbolism of he's not wearing two of the same kinds of shoes. He's wearing one shoe and one slipper. He has one pants leg rolled up. He has, instead of the straps of the backpack being over his shoulders, they're around him, right? So they're actually around his body. Some people have even said that the pin in his hat is actually a plum, the Masonic tool of the plum. And there's some other interpretations as well that why is the gate for the farm animals on the right, you know, the orderly side, why does the gate have this odd square cut out at the top left of the gate? Right? Wouldn't it just go normally from a diagonal from the upper left? And why does it jut up and form a square? So there's a lot of unanswered questions, but has been certainly a source of Masonic conspiracy, or at least interpretation, for many, many years. At the least of which being on the cover of A Pilgrim's Path by John J. Robinson, who wrote a book in the 80s about the religious right and their misinterpretation of Masonic principles. So, pretty neat.
I didn't hear anything you said after I caught a glimpse of the dude peeing in the corner.
I was focused ridiculous. On that one guy.
Transfixed. Well, I mean, yes.
Yeah, the wayfaring man that we know from a certain segment of Masonic ritual, second half of the third degree. I mean, of course, there's... I mean, it just looks foolish, like the fool, you know? There's a lot of that, also, the dog sort of down near the heels and things like that. But certainly we know Hieronymus Bosch to have painted many triptychs and many... many scenes that could be divided into a triptych sort of formula, like his Garden of Earthly Delights, etc.
Yes.
So I think it's interesting that we see that same motif here.
Mm-hmm. And uses a lot of the same symbolism of certain parakeets in different paintings, right, to represent certain things as well. So very good. Very
the
good
ka, the ka, or the ba, or the soul, like the bird is often a symbol of the soul being set free or otherwise.
Absolutely. So that was a little thing that we found that wasn't visible but was certainly referenced to in the show. Next up, we see the CIA enter in Peter Solomon's residence looking for clues, and they actually find quite a bit. What do they find here, Joe?
On the mantle, they find some Masonic things, regalia. The first one we see that I saw was the Royal Arch apron. It looks like one of those chintzy member aprons. You know what I mean? Like those cloth ones that you find.
He could have afforded something better. Yeah.
Yeah, he could have gotten something better, definitely. And then next to that is, looks like a picture of a bunch of Lodge brothers with some cool regalia. Got some tassels going on. Nothing too, you know, amazing there. And then on the left of that, in the right picture, there it looks like an old, either stitched or embroidered apron. You know, you see the sun, the moon, the square, and the compass. You see the level. I see a sun or the all-seeing eye up top, probably the all-seeing eye, and some pillars. But that's about it. Nothing too funky or conspiracy theory here. Just some regalia, as we all like to keep.
Mm-hmm. Right, so those in themselves are not, they don't have hidden meanings. They are things that you would typically see, you know, in, say, the background of Jason's or your background as well. So, but it's neat to point that out. The MacGuffin here is that the two main characters are located center of that shot, right? You had Peter Solomon and his architect of the Capitol friend there as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. But then as we learn some more about the architect. He says, well, actually, we're kind of keepers of the secrets because we are really an inner group of Masons. And there it is. That's what we were waiting for, right? The inner cabal, the inner circle of Freemasons. And he gives them a name. He says, in the book, they reference the 33rd degree quite a bit. But in here, they actually call themselves the Leviathan Group. So what is this Leviathan Group, Jason?
So, it's funny, Leviathan, I think elsewhere, and again, I talked to Maynard about this, like we were talking about earlier, but there's a certain seal of the Leviathan cross, which I think you even dealt with in an earlier ep, how it's a wax seal, and it's this certain lemniscate surmounted by what looks like a cross of Lorraine, and the Leviathan attribution to that is, I think, they're probably making a reference to Satanism, Luciferianism, things like that. Like a lot of people popularly think, post-Taxol, they get these crazy ideas that there's some satanic cabal, some inner order of Freemasons that are, Luciferian in some way. And I think it's pretty demonstrable. A cursory Google search will show you that in the late 60s, early 70s, Anton LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan in San Francisco in 66, reappropriated that symbol, which was an alchemical symbol for brimstone. He sort of appropriated that. Yeah, sulfur, brimstone, and he sort of reappropriated that as the Leviathan cross, like in reference to the sea monster Leviathan. So I think it's a relatively new way to look at that, certainly a late 20th century way to look at that, and has nothing on anything before 1969, so right. In terms of Satanism or Luciferianism.
Right. So obviously there is a Masonic group called the Leviathan Group, Jason?
No.
What?
when you look at fraternal societies that incorporate the name Leviathan, you come up with onesie twosie things here. There's the Fraternal Order of Leviathan and Leviathan Sororitas. And that's a professional fraternal society at a law college in the Philippines. You also have the Order of Leviathan, which is totally a group I want to join because they are literally an order of pirates. And so they meet every 2 years and they initiate 13 or 14, with the master's discretion, new members who are esteemed pirates of accomplishment and merit. And so,
I'm curious.
Yes, we were joking that their membership is so exclusive, much like CBCS, that we expect that next year the Order of Leviathan will be declared clandestine by the Grand Encampment.
Get those petitions in today, boys.
That's right.
But it's just, it's just fascinating. And you can go to the Order of Leviathan website and they have a picture of every single member and they are all dressed up as pirates.
It's pretty amazing. I don't know what to say about that, but yeah. It sounds cool. But not Masonic. It's not Masonic.
No, not at all.
Yes. Right. Again, this is definitely an adaptation of the TV series from the book, The Leviathan Cross, The Leviathan Group, is not mentioned at all in there. It's more of a 33rd degree thing.
And that kind of irked me a little bit. Like, yeah. they put so much mystique around the 33rd degree in the actual book. Why'd they go off on this making up their own crap thing? That had enough meat and potatoes to it to run with it, but they started, this new.
And there's enough conspiracy theories about the 33rd degree anyway, so
right,
they had plenty of stuff to go with.
I wanted to see Moloch drinking out of the human skull with the blonde wig on.
We still got time.
That's true.
You never know. Which, let's not talk 33rd degree, let's talk 32nd degree, because through the help of one of the police officers, Capitol police officers, they were able to acquire out of the evidence room Peter Solomon's 33rd degree ring, which we knew had to have some significance later on in the series. And it was quickly observed that Yod was missing from it. So let's talk. Let me switch over my screen here. And where in the some Masonic jurisdictions, the 14th degree of the Scottish Rite, you know, one of the groups that you can join after you become a Master Mason, you see in the upper right does have the Hebrew letter Yod or Yad on it. And they were using that to try to see, you know, what's the secret that's hidden on this ring. And in its place, you can see what looks to be a different character, which initially thought to be the Hebrew He, was actually, in fact, the number pi, a Greek letter pi. So what is, where, now we've gone from Hebrew to Greek in order to push the story along and decode those biblical verses, those Hebrew verses we saw earlier on in this episode. But you can see in the upper right, here's somewhat actual, 14th degree ring on the top, and an example of a 32nd degree ring, which does have the Yod on the side. So the Yod is a common symbol in Scottish Rite. And, you know, one of the more exoteric explanations of that is that it is the first letter of the Tetragrammaton, or Yod He Vav He, the true name of God. And so it becomes a symbol of God in that triangle. Anything else you guys want to add to that?
I think of it sometimes because it enumerates in its gematriac value, the letter Yud is also 10. So to have 10 in an equilateral triangle is to say the tetractys. You know, those, by that I so one dot, two dots, three dots, four dots, which enumerate to the number 10. So having a Yud in there kind of alludes to this, the tetractys of the Pythagoreans, you know, with it also sort of being, generative. So there is the idea, and I forget what current this kind of comes from, Yud being this sort of seminal element, right? So if it does have something to do with, then it is almost our G as well in some regards, you know? So I think there's ways to kind of navigate that Yud in an equilateral triangle where you could tie it into the tetractys, which we, do we not talk about that in the one of the lectures? We talk about an eminent brother, Pythagoras, and I know the tetractys is mentioned in certain appendant bodies, right. But.
Well, the thing is, too, is if for those Scottish Rite Masons, the Yud and the equilateral triangle, you also get to see it in that degree, right? Because that's something that's found, which if you get your Scottish Rite degrees, you'll see the rest of it. I don't know about the northern jurisdiction, but I know in the southern jurisdiction, it's a symbol for what you see in the degree, and they flesh it out there more. But yeah, absolutely. But we didn't find a Yud. We found something else.
A pi, a Greek letter pi. Again, pi. Really just used to mathematically, you know, circle corresponding letters and numbers within that. So really, I don't know. It was a cheap trick, but yeah, Joe.
That's right.
Yeah. Did anybody figure out what magic cipher he used to take the letter pi and then figure out what, like, yeah, I didn't get that at all. And I'm a relatively smart dude.
Yeah. So he was like saying, like, it was, pi is 3.14159265355, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yes, I did memorize it early on. And one of the things is he's taking like the third letter of the first word. And so it was like looking at the corresponding numbers and then the fourth letter of the first word. It was really weird. So I think it was rushed for show, and they could have done a better job of doing that. Again, not in the book. So again, they had some source material to actually challenge the observer, challenge the viewer. But at this point, we're along for the ride.
So they use the decimal expanse of pi as a substitution cipher?
Yes.
Unlike in National Treasure, right? When they pay the kid a dollar to go read off of a word, and then they'd say, you know, the
Silas Do-Good's letters. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
Yep. So not unlike that. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, those are all of the signs and symbols that we found. Did you find any others? And I want to make sure if you did, comment in the episode below so we can all share in that. And, you know, that's it for this week's episode. If you want to see more content of Signs and Symbols of Freemasonry writ large, subscribe to this channel, the Masonic Roundtable, and we will see you next week.